Battery's okay?
It's
yeah,
okay.
Okay. Thank you. So thanks for joining. Now it's Friday, so I have to be a bit more entertaining. So the latter part of the talk is a little bit technical. So depending on how you feel, we might stay with the more introductory material and spend more time there, and leave the rest at slightly less detail. So. I assume that most of you probably don't have too much of a background in electrical engineering or these types of things, so I'll have to give a quick, neither do I, right? I learned this stuff on the go. Slobodan has, but you're an electrical engineer by training, so
yep.
the first 15 minutes today that you're excused, basically, because I'm not telling you anything new. But for the rest of you, I thought it would be useful to introduce a few basic concepts just to give a perspective on what the relevance of the attacks that I will be talking about actually are. So I'll give you an introduction on sort of fast and loose power networks. Then I will talk about state estimation, which is the type of management mechanism that I'm actually going to be attacking. Little bit about related work, not so much, and then I will talk about specifics of state estimators and how we've attacked that. That's sort of the more in-depth technical part, and as I said, I may compress that a little bit in order to keep it sufficiently light for Friday. So obviously, electrical power networks are probably the most important part of the electrical infrastructure, because even your smartphones, they don't last very long if you can't recharge them very quickly. And they're also, I mean, for me, from a research perspective, they are mostly interesting as a specimen of a critical infrastructure. And they're interesting because they require very fast response times. Right, so the power network can fail very quickly, whereas, let's say, if you have a water distribution network or something like that, it's a bit more forgiving. So, cyber-physical systems, and this is sort of a very fashionable topic the last couple of years, what are some of the key characteristics, and at least the ones that I'm mostly interested in? Well, it's already in the word. It has to interact with the physical environment, which means that you have sensors and actuators. And that can be old-fashioned components, can be Internet of Things, but ultimately you take measurements and you have to communicate measurements. That is a very important part of any of these cyber-physical systems. Of course, then ultimately we do something, we have to actually take action based on this, but my talk is mostly going to be concerned with the measurement part and stop basically at that point. So the aspects, what we use those measurements for, the control side, because usually this is a feedback type mechanism, I'm not going to go into too much detail there. It's kind of understandable that, yes, of course, you need to keep systems in a desirable state, and that is the job of control systems. That's an entire discipline, control engineering in its own right. So I'll just really touch on this very briefly. A lot of control decisions have to happen in real time. Right? And that's another reason why electrical power networks are such a nice example, because they really force you to do things in a very strict level. So, and to give you an idea, the time scales that you have to take decisions sometimes are on the order of milliseconds. So, for example, if there's an attack, if there's a problem, you don't have time to think about what's going wrong. If your response doesn't happen in a few milliseconds, bad things happen. And unlike in other information security environments, you don't have the luxury of switching off or rebooting if something doesn't work. It has to keep functioning, right? Unlike our IT infrastructure, the electrical power network cannot be shut down for 2-3 hours at the weekend in order to make some fixes. So even if you know you have a problem, if you know that there's some measurements that are wrong, if there's some faults, you have to continue operating. Very different from the way that most people working in IT and IT security work. You cannot reboot the power network. And you have similar problems also in other control systems, right? You would be very upset if your car dealer was telling you that you have to just, you know, if there's a problem with the brakes when you're driving on the E6, just reboot the car. It's not that appealing. But one of the challenges that the control systems has is in order to take a meaningful decision, it has to know what the current state of the system is. Right? So if you use the car's brakes as an example, the anti-lock system needs to know how fast the wheels are spinning, all of them, in order to take a decision, am I going to brake this wheel more, am I going to brake that wheel more, or are you going sideways in the ditch? So that's control systems in general. Now let's have a very quick look at power networks and power systems. So traditionally, so before we talk about fancy things like smart grids, like the distributed power generation, the way that the power network is organized is conventionally that you have a few large central power stations. They are organized in a grid connected by something called the transmission grid, which is of the high-level networks, very high voltage. You see that at the top. So depending on which country we're in, 300, 400 kilovolt lines. I mean, this is an example from the UK, but doesn't really make that much difference. And then you go down to medium and lower voltage distribution networks, so that by the end that you reach sort of the residential area, you're down to 33 or 11 kilovolts, depending on whether that's an industrial consumer or not. And in order to make all this work, to have a certain amount of redundancy, if a power station fails, all of these are connected in a network. And failures happen all the time. Right, equipment failures, scheduled maintenance and all that. And you don't want the city to go black if something doesn't quite work. So you have the ability, so if you something goes wrong on this side of the network, you can compensate at another place. Consequence of this is the European power grid is the largest man-made machine ever created. It's a continental scale system that has to be in perfect synchronization. All the generators have to be running at exactly the same frequency or bad things will happen. It's a pretty tremendous job that you have to do there. Right? And the tolerances are really small. If you go slightly above, which is to say there's too much generator capacity but not enough load to balance it, then you might have an overspeed condition on one of the turbines, for example. Smoke, bad things. Or the other way around, if there's not enough generator capacity, then power stations start tripping offline, and that means a small failure can cascade into a blackout at a much larger scale. We don't have too many of those, but there's plenty of other countries like US and Canada a couple of years back on a regular scale in countries like India, Pakistan, where there's just not enough capacity to go around where these things happen. And it's the job of the so-called TSO, transmission system operator, to basically dispatch load, say, I need more capacity here, you should reduce power and all that. And worst case, they do something called load shedding, in which case you basically have to tell a consumer or a region of a city, I can't provide for you anymore. And the TSO needs to know the state of the network at all times. So I don't know if this is going to work. So Statnett is the Norwegian TSO. These are the current power flows in the Nordic grid. Right, so you see that between those regions, there's not a perfect balance. So some regions generate more, some generate a little bit less. This is live data. And you see national level import-export during daytime, nighttime. Usually there's some export going on, mostly to Sweden and also to other parts of the country. And what you can see, right? So we're in a very luxurious situation because there's a lot of generating capacity, and most of the time there's some room for export. And this is so the price per megawatt. Unfortunately, that's not the retail price that you pay. Okay. And to give you an idea of the scale, I know this is a bit difficult to read. So these are sort of the ultra high voltage transmission lines in the Nordic grid. And they're all connected to the European grid as well. Okay. Power engineers like to confuse people. When they say security, they mean safety. So all of this has to happen at very different scales. So very small transients can happen at the microsecond level, and some events like scheduling power station users can happen on the order of hours or days. What we are concerned with here is mostly the space in between, sort of in the millisecond to second range. That's the dynamics that we're looking for. At the longer scales, this is basically it's market-based mechanism. So saying that, you know, I can provide this many megawatt hours for this many kroner, and another provider will bid at a different price, so that basically the TSO gets the best possible price. But the job of the EMS, the energy management system, is to deal with sort of this shorter term situation. So you have to do load forecasting and resource scheduling. So, for example, this is very precise that using a UK example again, you know exactly, basically, if it's half time during a football match, power consumption will go up. So you need to provide extra generator capacity because at half time people will be switching on the kettle and will make another cup of tea. And if a couple million people do that, you notice it. Right? But in real time, when you cannot forecast, you have to monitor what's going on and have to react to various parameters. So there might be a spontaneous failure, there might be some differences in power consumption, and all this needs to be managed. And just as an example, this is sort of a control room, current generation control room, and there's a lot happening beneath that. Now, we're moving to smart grid, at least in most parts of Europe. Again, here in Norway, we are very in a luxurious situation because most of the power generation is done hydroelectrically, and it's done by turbines. Turbines are good, right? Because turbines have something called inertia. So if you make a small mistake and your frequency is a little bit too high or a little bit too low, the mechanical inertia of the turbine basically deals with this. If you exaggerate, the turbine makes a funny noise and starts walking. This thing here weighs about 400 tons, just a rotating assembly. But you can see the energy that's stored there, if you have a small imbalance, that can compensate for some mistakes. Problem is now, in most of Europe, we're switching to renewable energy. You have photovoltaics, you have wind energy. You no longer have these big hulking turbines that basically give you room to correct mistakes by sheer value of their inertia. So in other words, it becomes more important to have very fine-grained control over what's going on in the power network. And for that, we need something called state estimation. So what do we mean by state? Now, in an electrical power network, we mean what I would like to know in order to control this. I would like to know all of the voltages, all of the phase angles for each one of the buses that are connected. That's what I would like to have. And these are called the state variables. Okay, now you might ask, okay, why don't you just measure it? Go ahead and do it. Well, because it's expensive. So, to give you an idea, the Polish national grid, I know that because Poland actually is one of the few countries that releases that information. Just the transmission grid has on the order of 10,000 bus bars. And you would need to take multiple measurements on that different locations redundantly, right, because things might fail. And you would then have to aggregate and communicate all that in real time. At the moment, at least, that seems pretty expensive. And when I say expensive, a single device for measuring the phase angle correctly, a so-called PMU, synchrophasor measurement unit, costs about 1 million kroner. 10,000 bus bars? Ooh. Right. The customer will not stand for that. So you end up basically taking as many measurements as you can get away with, and the rest you have to estimate based on the parameters that you do have. And again, because you have to collect that in real time, aggregating all this synchronously is also an issue. So a little bit more formally, so in we have measurements, and in addition, what we need is also we need to have for unknown state variables, we need to interpolate the variables that we are actually looking for. So the measurements themselves are not perfect. Any type of measurement will have an error associated with it, and that's even before we start any attacks. And what we would normally do, and I'll get to that in a bit more detail later on, what you would normally need to do is you need to have some type of statistical predictive model that says, well, this is most likely the correct interpolated value that I get here. There's a number of different approaches for doing that. They differ quite a lot in how complicated they are. They range from sort of static to time-sliced models to dynamic models, but the models that just about everyone in the literature uses, just because it's complicated enough, is so-called static or quasi-static models, and that's what we're going to use here as well. And state estimation is really a very common theme in any type of cyber-physical systems. So, in fact, this was originally formulated in aerospace systems because, basically the military needed to know if it was shooting a missile, it needed to know based on imperfect measurements whether it was going roughly in the same direction. And the power engineers basically only caught on to that in the early 1960s, that we would like to have that as well. So what we're doing is now we're using this very simple model of a static state estimator model. As I said, we need to have the voltage and phase angle for all of the edges, which means the bus bars. And we assume that we have so-called real and reactive power flow. That's the VARs that you've seen a little bit earlier, and rely on our static formulation. For the actual estimate, there's a number of different algorithms. We're again using what everyone else is using, so-called weighted least squares. There's better algorithms for performing this estimate, but it's fast and it is well known. So for all else being equal, that's what we end up using as well. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to come up with values for the estimated parameters that are matching with the measurements that you actually have. And you have to approximate that. Right? You start with a certain guess for the values that you think the unknown state variable should have, and then you optimize the error based on your guesses, saying that, okay, if I change the estimated variables a little bit, it will start matching better the errors of what I see from the real measurements. And this is an iterative process. So what you see here is basically the classic formulation, basically the estimated state variable in the kth iteration is x bar, and you see g is the gain matrix, so how much I'm modifying my estimate. We have the delta, so the changes that I'm introducing at each iteration, and h is the Jacobian, the covariance error matrix, we have r, and then we are taking the measurement vector and the mapping of the previous state into the measurements, that's my age. Okay. Sorry. As I've said before, there is a problem that's well known that sensors can fail or that can just give bad values. That's been known for a very long time. And so there have been simple statistical techniques employed again since the 1960s to identify outliers, essentially. So using a statistical model that says if I have a value that should be in the range of between 20 and 35 and I get a value of a constant zero, that probably means that there's something wrong. Or if I get something that is at the far end of the measurement scale, I'll just drop it out. And I use I have the more formal definition in a later slide, but essentially the way that you can visualize that is I just throw away some measurements that look implausible. Now, a few years ago, so 5-6 years ago, there were a couple of researchers that thought, that seems like a very crude and simple way of determining if a value isn't quite right. And they were starting to investigate, well, what if I carefully design fake measurements? I mean, you have to imagine you're talking about measurements that get taken at the scale of the entire country. Physical security is almost impossible. Right? You go somewhere in the countryside, you climb up on a pole, you can fiddle with a sensor and nobody will know. Or you can you get a communication line. Now things are starting to get encrypted. Until quite recently, it was fairly common that you would take a measurement and there would be a microwave relay that would beam the values down along the line in unencrypted form. So what you could do in that case is get sufficiently high up, get a slightly stronger microwave transmitter and just transmit something else, and the receiver would be happy to take it instead. And if there's no authentication, if there's no cryptographic protection, what's stopping me? So, malicious bad data injection has, at least that's what most of the articles in the literature are pursuing, has as its goal to basically give some fake measurements that forces the state estimator into a state that doesn't correspond to reality. Okay? So the energy management system and ultimately the operator will think that the system is in state one when in fact it is in a different state. And it will respond to the fake state and make a mistake. So, for example, I'm giving you the fake impression that there is a lot less demand than there really is. So what will the energy management system do? It will shut down the power station. Consequence of that, the failures start cascading, and if you're really lucky, you can provoke a blackout. So, but surprisingly, what we found the last 2-3 years, and that's the scale in which we start to investigate some of these things, a lot of these models just assume that, first of all, there's a single centralized instance, and it doesn't work that way anymore. And they also assume that the measurements get transmitted from the edge of our power network to the state estimator by magic. They arrive instantly at the same time from all over the country. Okay, that's not quite right. So, and I'll probably skip over this. This is just of the more precise explanation what I've just given. So these are some criteria for how I can design an error such that your detector will not find it. Right? Because obviously the information of the criteria that this bad data detector is using is public. I know the algorithm, so I can carefully design error parameters where I know, okay, this is the test that you're using? Fantastic. I will carefully calibrate all the data that it will fit the test but it will still give me the desired result, which is to drive you in an undesirable state. I mean, I'm happy to share those slides. So that, for example, this is one of the seminal papers, so I have a hyperlink there. Otherwise, you can follow up on that. So there's, at last count, about 600 papers that talk about various flavors of bad data injection. So this has been done rather at length. What I'd like to very briefly, again, I'll probably just skip over some of the technical details later on. What I would like to very briefly introduce is sort of a notion of a hierarchical state estimator, just to deal with the complexity of these things, because again, you're dealing with potentially continental scale. We've published that last year at ISGT. That's a smart grid conference. Essentially, the idea is that you don't have just a single state estimator, but that you have a hierarchy or an unbalanced tree of state estimators, so that, for example, if something goes wrong at some level of the state estimator, you don't have your eggs in one basket. It would be pretty undesirable to have a single point of failure in something as important as this. So what we've designed is a hierarchical state estimator that has to form a tree, because ultimately there needs to be a coordinating instance, but which can be repartitioned, especially automatically, papers on that as well, in case something goes wrong and, for example, we have to cut off a part of the network because we know that the state estimate from this part of the network is unreliable, maybe because it's subject to an attack. And the way that you, again, I have the precise details here on the slide, but the way that you can think about this is that you start with the measurements at the bottom of the actual real measurements. You perform a low-level state estimate. The initial state estimate gets propagated to the next layer in the tree until you reach the root. And that's then your current best guess for the state of the system. The root coordinates all of the leaves, and then it pushes down the next iteration, and you repeat that a few times until all of the state estimators are in agreement. And obviously that has to happen fast. Okay, so again, the slide here has sort of the slightly more precise details, and you can see that the matrices that we have to exchange are quite large, so we have to be a bit careful with what we are actually exchanging here. But at least we are able to characterize what we're exchanging. We're not relying on magic. So then, of course, we design the model, and then we try to break our own model. Fairly standard procedure. And what we were thinking was that, okay, let's assume that our state estimator people are doing it right and are using strong authentication. They're using some protective mechanisms for the sensors and all that. So instead of doing all the stupid things that they're doing at the moment, they would be doing everything right. Is that a reasonable assumption? Well, maybe not, but let's do it for a moment. So the assumption would be that you can even no longer attack the sensors. The communication channels are secure. So what's left? Well, what we thought was, okay, then the only thing left is basically the communication channel itself. Basically, manipulating things like jamming, like denial of service, which don't really care whether the channel is encrypted and authenticated or not. So, in other words, what we're doing is we're assuming a much weaker attacker than the conventional model. What we don't do is we don't do explicit channel modeling, the integrity of the transmission, we're ignoring that. We are using a combination of DC and AC power flows, but that's more for the stability of the power network. And for the sake of simplicity, we also assume that the topology of the network does not change, because that just adds a little bit to the complication. And it's a static model, as I said before. So again, first we try to create a robust model and then we break it. So one of the things that we've used is we dug out something called a continuation power flow model that has desirable characteristics for stability, because it's a reasonably benign, shows reasonably benign behavior, especially if you have a slightly ill-conditioned matrix in the Jacobian, right? Because you're performing multiple iterations and you're performing numerical operations, matrix inversions, with values that are very close to zero. Right? And what happens if you have a finite precision computation that you, and you're dividing with a value that's very close to zero? You get huge errors. So ill-conditioned matrices are a bit of a bugbear in these situations. So the power flow problem can be formulated as this, and then we iterate over the conventional power flow algorithm, as you can see here. CPF is at its heart, again, and you have the slides here, CPF is at its heart, it's a reasonably straightforward flavor of a Newton-Raphson approximation algorithm. It's a linear approximation algorithm. As I said, it is dependent a little bit on the conditioning of the matrix. So in the next few slides, I'm just using one particular instance as an example, but obviously that is really just for illustration purposes. And what we need to do is we need to see sort of what the decreasing, hopefully, error value is between each iteration of this. And what we should have is we should have values that are nicely uniformly smooth, but you can get singularities if you have a phase transition. And that's, of course, what an attacker can misuse. Right? So we've used a few tricks to use, for example, a smoothing function to make sure that if you just inject, or if you were to inject some values, that it wouldn't just completely go out of bounds on the first attempt. The fact that we use the smoothing function has the slight disadvantage that it takes a bit longer to go to convergence, but that's a price worth paying. So the bad measurements can come from faulty measurement devices, can be deliberate attacks. There's a couple of assumptions that we have to make. But one observation that I'd just like to share is that so if you have bad measurements, one of the things is that we've observed is that the squares of differences between the observed measurements and their corresponding estimate, they can become quite large. And that was the starting point for our attack. We're saying that, okay, if we can provoke an attack that really just introduces delays, if I just introduce delays on the communication channel, that might be sufficient to provoke precisely this type of behavior. And the nice thing is, for me as an attacker, I don't even need to worry about whether I have detailed knowledge of the network topology. So the beauty of this attack that I'm just describing here is that I don't need a lot of knowledge or a lot of capabilities on the part of the attacker. What we've tried out, and there's more to be done, but this is what we've tried out, is first of all, we tried random delays. No particular intelligence required, we're just introducing random delays on the channel. And the second attempt was then to say, okay, and now we use a little bit of intelligence in structuring the delays, so to modulate the channel a little bit on top. And our attacker can have a number of different objectives. One is, as with the case of the other bad data injection attacks, to just force a particular state. Admittedly, that's a bit more difficult in this case because we don't get to choose the parameters. Or much more fun, you know, we're in the security business, we break stuff. One of the things that can happen is that you get non-convergence. The state estimator simply doesn't come up with a solution. What does that do for the energy management system? You're going blind. No, you just don't. The state estimator basically, instead of giving you an estimate for the current state of the system, it just says, sorry. Not a number, ill-conditioned matrix, I'm not feeling well. So, that's the idea. And it turns out, and I'll just give you a couple of examples here, it turns out that, oh yes, that works. So, I'll give you the example here for the standard IEEE 118 bus network, because it's difficult to fit that on slides. The partitioning that we're using for this hierarchical state estimator have a couple of conditions, but that's probably not so exciting. We're using a three-level state estimator. So this is a standard IEEE test model system. This is part of the US Western Power Transmission Network. Again, not very large, but it has to fit on a slide. And you see sort of the dotted lines is how that gets partitioned into these smaller state estimators. And these charts show you what happens when we perform a random, so the most stupid type of delay attack, by introducing attacks. And as you remember from the introduction, we have sort of the amplitude and we have the phase, those two parameters. So you see on the bottom, the x-axis is the iteration number of the power flow algorithm, and then you have the bus bars up to 118 on the vertical axis. And you basically, you get the error parameter in the color scheme. So what you would like to have is, you would like to have a nice, smooth, uniform display. The pretty colors are evil. And even this very stupid attack allowed us to get a 20% deviation from what should be measured. At that point, some equipment might break. Use a slightly different setup. And now we do a structured attack where we put a bit more intelligence into this. Color scheme is a little bit different. Blame MATLAB for that. It's just because the range is very large, you had to compress that somehow. So basically, amplitude variations were more or less in the same range, 30-40%. But phase angle deviation was 70-80%. So in other words, all over the place. That's the point when equipment trips and things go black. So, what I've tried to do today is not only to get you to buy more candles and wood-fired stoves, that might also be an option, but to show also that by, let's say, querying a little bit the assumptions that people are making in how they design certain algorithms, whether it might not be possible to come up with novel types of attacks that actually require very little capabilities on the part of the attacker. Right? So part of the game, or part of the objectives for this type of work, was to say, okay, how stupid can we behave as an attacker, or how limited can we be in terms of the resources, and still produce a pronounced effect? And I think, you know, it has worked quite well. We got a nice paper out of it, or actually several nice papers. I presented that earlier this month at SmartGrid.com, which is a nice conference. And I'll have to conclude, I'm leaving 1-2 minutes for questions. I have to conclude here with acknowledging the people that provided our funding. And also, of course, that this is not work that I do, and I just get to present it. The actual work, as everyone knows, was done by PhD students and postdocs. So that was Yang Yi Feng. She's now working back in China at Deloitte. Alessio Baiocco, he's almost finished with his PhD. Chiara, who's at Roma Tre, and my colleague Stefano, who's also at Roma Tre. So that's it. Thank you. If they are redundant, it will make this more robust in general. But that would be true for the attacks, the bad data injection that I've shown earlier, because it becomes more difficult to hide. But if you do the type of attacks that I've just described, it doesn't matter, right? Because I'm just delaying measurements, and whether I delay 100 or 1,000 measurements, the effect is going to be the same. Well, this is again where we're actually making ourselves more vulnerable. So it gets worse in some sense, because the way that traditionally these measurements get communicated used to be by dedicated lines. So if you ever were to climb on a high voltage transmission tower, what you would see is that at the very top, there is usually a very thin line, which is a fiber optic cable. It's not carrying power, it's carrying data from all these measuring devices. Now,